Thank you. Good morning, Council. We are here on cases 824-1671, 825-0125, Shanai Feltes versus Jeffrey Nimala. My apologies if I've mispronounced those, but you'll correct me. Et al. Remax Thousand Lakes. Feltes respondent, Nimala appellants, and third party defendant Remax. Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal arguments. And when you begin, if you could please state your name and a party you represent for the record. Council for appellant, you will have appellants, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And when this case is being, these arguments are being conducted via Zoom, we will maintain only an audio recording for our public website afterwards. If you could keep yourself muted when you're not speaking, that would be appreciated. And counsel for appellants, we are ready for you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Miles Ringsred, and I represent appellants Jeffrey and Linda Nimala. We're here today on appeal from the district court's order finding the Nimalas in contempt and awarding attorney's fees following what was a documented and diligent effort to comply with a vague court-approved settlement agreement. The issues on appeal, there are many, but the main ones are whether contempt was properly found, where the underlying order lacked the necessary clarity, the record lacks evidence of willful noncompliance, and whether governmental delays and other delays due to respondents' own efforts and shifting of title demands, which made literal compliance with the original time frame impossible. Now, the standard of review for contempt is that a court can reverse a contempt finding where the district court's decision is unsupported by the evidence or reflects improper application of the law. That's from In Re, Commissioner of Public Safety, 735 Northwest 2nd, 706, as stated in appellant's principal brief. As we explained in our brief as well, and as supported by the record, the district court's ruling should be reversed both because it is unsupported by the evidence and because it reflects a misapplication of the law. And rather than reiterate what's already been stated in our appellant's brief, I'd like to focus this time by opening this up for any questions that this court has.
Well, Mr. Ringsred, I have a question, and that your first argument is, I think it's the best way to describe it is to quote your heading on page 16 of your brief, that a contempt applies only where there is bad faith, disrespect, intentional disobedience. I think your argument here is that your client had good faith, engaged in due diligence, made efforts during this period of time in between the settlement and the contempt hearing, but so therefore should not be held in contempt. I guess I'm looking for any case law in which that's similar or analogous, where an appellate court has reversed a district court's finding of contempt for similar grounds. And it seems like you cite two cases here, MSBA and HOP. I think they're different. MSBA is where a person refused to testify because of a privilege. It's, you know, kind of an absolute matter that prevented the person from testifying. The other case, HOP, was where the person was required to make alimony payments and simply didn't have the money. So, I mean, but are there any cases that are more similar to this in the sense that a party had an obligation to do something, made some efforts, but wasn't successful in satisfying the criteria that was required and therefore was held in contempt, but the appellate court reversed? Long question, but that I think that's one of the important questions in the case.
I would agree that's a fairly central aspect of this. And as the court, I would maybe have to go and find other district courts and decisions. But as far as appellate court or Supreme Court decisions, that there was nothing necessarily exactly on point, which is why, as we typically do, have to kind of go and find the principles or the reasoning behind those decisions. And I think such a, and as you said, the kind of reasoning in Minnesota State Bar and Hop v. Hop, while they're not exactly analogous, they are certainly, they express the principles and the reasoning behind those, such as the privilege. It's sort of a standard of sort of the impossibility that we're trying to say, or same with Hop v. Hop, the impossibility of making those alimony payments. Whereas here, it's, I don't want to parse it too much, but there's certainly the two different tracks. There was the title issue for the manufactured home, but then also the sort of the real estate that went along with it. And really the impossibility of from Hop v. Hop is very much reflected in this matter, where essentially the really since 2014, when the conditions for transferring that title were accepted by the respondent in the from the title company who did the title commitment and was accepted, and then even after the litigation, the trial, and the settlement, purportedly we're still accepting that title commitment and moving forward under that understanding until and really, according to really the definition of marketable title, something that the buyer would accept, they presumably accepted it until it is impossible to comply with the terms that weren't provided within the time frame. It is just not possible to comply with the new set of terms that was sent to appellants nearly 2 months after the 90-day time frame had elapsed. And so while there, to answer your question, then there's nothing directly on point, as most cases always have differences, but really being able to draw on the principles and the reasoning behind those opinions, you do see a lot of the analogies and analogous reasons why this court should reverse.
I have another question, which is switching to a slightly different issue, and that is, when I look at the contempt order at the last page, it seems like there are two consequences of the finding of contempt. Paragraph 3 of the order there imposes a new deadline and has sort of specific steps that defendants shall take. And then in paragraph 2, there's an order to pay cost and attorney's fees. And am I correct? Those are the only two consequences of the contempt order?
I would say mainly the, I guess that is a consequence of it, in terms of number 3, the 45 days, where I would say the main consequence was the award of costs and attorney's fees, whereas the other one was more of the court agreeing with and just requiring that appellants now comply with the demands that respondent made in late February.
So I guess I was kind of setting up my second question, which is, would you agree that the relief ordered by the court there in those two paragraphs provides context for our review of the district court's decision? And so it seems like paragraph 3 is intended, it appears, to obtain compliance with the original order and to fulfill the settlement, and paragraph 2 is to compensate plaintiff for the expenses incurred in bringing the motion. And so, and, you know, it might be a different case if defendants were ordered to go to jail until they complied, but in this case it's really about getting compliance with the settlement agreement and paying plaintiff for the expenses of this motion. I mean, would you agree that that frames our review differently than if there were more or greater consequences?
Not, I don't think that necessarily being ordered to go to jail or necessarily the severity changes the unfairness and sort of the absurdity of this, where it when you say it's about to compel compliance with the settlement order, another big aspect of our arguments is that contempt needs to be the order was not specific; it was vague. All it said was to do whatever is necessary, and that's something that came up a number of times where whatever is necessary is vague, and they were doing whatever is necessary. What are everyone pretty much in the state of Minnesota would do in this context is engage a title company who sends stuff to their underwriter, identifies the things that need to be done in which they would ensure that transaction. That's exactly what happened here. And again, they purportedly accepted that. And then it was after the 90 days. So the new 45, within 45 days having to do A through G, were all the items that were identified after the 90-day deadline had elapsed. It was impossible to do that. And so I think in terms of the severity or any of this, I think it needs to, and we pointed out in our brief, is just how, one, there are other alternatives, remedies that were available, whether it was breach of contract, just kind of the purpose behind contempt, but that it would have been perfectly reasonable for the court and a lot more reasonable in this context to basically recognize the efforts that had been going on and give the parties time to comply with the respondents changing the goalposts after the deadline that the court had set in the original agreement. And so, again, I don't think it's necessarily the severity that warrants whether this was right or wrong. I think it's certainly an aspect, but I think that cuts the other way in so far as there were certainly other options that this court and reasonable options that this court had rather than a finding of contempt based on the circumstances and the timing of all of this.
Could you please summarize the reasons why the initial order was unclear or vague? I forget the term you used. And I guess I'm wondering, is it more than simply the requirement that, is it the do whatever is needed language, or does your argument go beyond that?
I would say, I mean, it's the do whatever is necessary or needed. I can't remember the exact terminology, but yes, it would be that. I mean, that's about as vague as it can get. Whatever is needed is they appellants again did what any.
It's not just whatever is needed. It's whatever is needed to transfer marketable title, and I think you need to make sure that that clause includes transfer marketable title. Here's my question for you, Mr. Ringsred, and I'm sorry if I cut off your answer, but you know your client, the Nemelas, were questioned by the court as to whether they understand the terms of the agreement. What is your best argument that we should now say they didn't get it, they didn't understand whatever is needed to convey marketable title when there is a question and answer with the court? Do you understand this? You hash it out. Your clients are saying, I do. Do you have any questions? No, I don't have any questions. What's your strongest argument that now is demonstrates that they didn't get what they were supposed to do?
I wouldn't say that they didn't understand what they were supposed to do. They understood that they were.
Whatever is necessary to convey marketable title, they did understand what they needed to do. Is that what you're saying now?
Well, I'm not saying that they didn't understand, but that's, I think, where maybe some of the ambiguity comes in here. Whatever is necessary to convey marketable title, what that is contacting a real estate expert, a title company that can make these types of opinions, who they're not the, like, a seller is not going to tell the buyer what the terms are that they need to accept. It's the title company the experts who do these kind of searches, and that's to convey marketable title. They did what someone should do to convey marketable title. And again, the definition of marketable title is what a reasonable, prudent person knowing all the facts and so forth. And the buyer, since 2014 until, again, they added these additional terms, they had purportedly accepted that the terms that were part of that original title commitment. It's they moved forward and did everything that they were told to do, what they rely on expert title companies in order to convey marketable title. And so again, I don't think it's necessarily, they don't understand all the necessities and the complex aspect of title transfers and documents and possibly missed interests and things like that. And so almost everyone in the state would be going to a title company and rely on a title company to determine what needed to be done in order to convey marketable title. And that was done in this circumstance. I see I only have 20 seconds left if there's no other questions.
Well, I have one more question. The phrase, you know, do whatever is necessary or whatever is necessary to deliver marketable title. It seems to me that's basically equivalent to deliver marketable title. And if the requirement of this of the order was to deliver marketable title, you would probably have no, or would you have any remaining argument that that order is unclear or vague?
Could you repeat the question? Sorry.
Yeah. So I guess the question is, what if the court in its earlier order, immediately after the settlement, had simply ordered your clients to deliver marketable title, period? Would that have been clear, or would it suffer from the same type of lack of clarity or vagueness that you're complaining about here?
I would say it's a little bit different than do whatever is necessary, but it would suffer from the same level of vagueness to a degree. But that gets into sort of the definition of marketable title and part of the issue that really has confounded this, where again, the Nemulas had essentially marketable title, at least according to the definition, where they went to a title expert, the title company, who was able to give a title opinion and said, here are the conditions and the title issues that we see that need to be rectified in order for them to provide insurance for that transaction. And so it's sort of like beauty, is it's in the eye of the beholder. And so if for some reason, which in this case, the respondent at a certain point decided, you know what, we're not going to just trust what that the title company said, and chose to go out on their own volition to hire a title attorney, I believe, who is their expert, who then identified some of these other issues, which after identifying those, brought them to our attention after the 90-day deadline. And then Mr. Nemula brought them to the title company, who then confirmed and said, well, actually, yeah, we were mistaken and we agree with respondent's title expert. And then Mr. Nemula said, okay, well, let's start getting these things done. It's not like he wasn't not trying to comply. It was just the after the 90-day deadline of shifting the goalposts and then crying foul and saying that nothing was done to try to convey marketable title. If you look in the affidavits in the background facts section, everything that was needed to be done in order to convey marketable title pursuant to the original terms was done and ready to go. They had signed the.
I'm just going to interrupt to ask if Judge Johnson, was your question answered regarding the vagueness of if it had been worded?
Yes. Okay. I think my question was answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Ringsrud, if you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, but I think we're veering into whether there was compliance with it versus the question. So thank you. We'll turn to counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Eric Honkanen. I represent respondent in this manner, Shawnee Feltes, who's with me here today, and may it please the court. I guess I would start with a couple things in terms of the statements made by Mr. Ringsrud that there was experts hired or that the Nemulas got a title opinion. Those are found in paragraph 8 of the contempt order, that those actually didn't occur. That's the issue. They should have hired a title expert. They should have gotten a title opinion. That did not happen at all. What Mr. Ringsred is essentially trying to argue is that the asking of a closing agent who is not a title expert is basically a person that prepares paperwork, that that was the reliance on that. And the court rejected that, and there wasn't actually a title opinion done. Furthermore, it was repeatedly said throughout the case, even before the motion was filed, that the there needed to be a corrective order stemming from the subject property regarding Janice Davis. That was improperly done in 2020, where Mr. Niemela had had a decree of dissent issued to him, as opposed to Janice Davis. That was identified as being an issue because the creditor cannot take under a decree of dissent. It had to go to a family member. That wasn't even begun to be embarked upon until after the beginning of this appeal, which is why we were asking for the court to take judicial notice of the Donald D. Davis estate matter, because that was just simply never done, even within the 45 days, and known all the way back to 2020 that there was also medical assistance issues in this case that were not cleared up. And so there's no moving of the goalposts in this case at any point in time by appellant the respondent in this matter, my client, as she was simply just demanding that she receive marketable title. And so because the Niemelas didn't want to spend the money or otherwise get the effort to or do the effort to carry out what was needed to transfer marketable title, which, by the way, was Mr. Ringsred's suggestion in the settlement hearing of doing whatever is necessary to have marketable title. Weren't my words. They weren't the court's words. They were Mr. Ringsred's words, because it is an objective standard. And so here we are today. My client still doesn't have record title or marketable title to the property, and since, I don't know, almost 2 years now. And so with regard to this, there was no shifting demands. And this settlement wasn't vague. It was like, provide marketable title. Because marketable title is an objective standard, they should have gone and hired a title expert and gotten a title opinion. As I told Mr. Ringsred very bluntly in an email, you need to hire a title expert and get in a title opinion, somebody to do the title review. Well, that costs money, and the Niemelas didn't want to do that. And so they tried to just do everything on their own. And with regard to title issues, everything has to be done very correctly, in the right order, and it just hasn't happened. And so we're still here today because of these issues. And my client doesn't have title. And so here we are on appeal. And, you know, had they just hired a title expert and had a title opinion done, those issues would have been identified. Because they didn't, my client had to go and hire a title expert, which then the defendants subsequently agreed to, even before the and knew about all of these issues, and then didn't comply. Then I had to bring an order to show cause. There was another lapse of time between the time of the filing of the motion and the hearing. There was nothing done there. Then there was nothing done after the 45 days to correct all of the title issues necessary in order to give my client marketable title, such as fixing the Donald D. Davis estate case issue. It just simply never was done. And so, yeah, the court appropriately found the appellants in contempt and ordered attorney's fees. And I would also, because of this, if this court affirms, be asking for additional attorney's fees. And that's all I have, Your Honor.
Okay, seeing no questions from the panel, thank you. And counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes. Appellants, you have 5 minutes.
I'd just like to highlight a couple of things, because it would seem that respondents would certainly agree that stating that there was no title opinion, which is just incorrect. It's just a misunderstanding or just misstatement of what the title process is with a company. It's not just relying on some title company employee it's sent to an underwriter and people who can provide title commitments and so forth. On page 30 of our brief, we talk about, this is just one of the examples of the errors of law that the district court made. And in Mattson Ridge LLC, where it clearly states, when it's talking about the definition of marketable title, that Minnesota law is clear in determining whether title is free from, quote, reasonable doubt, courts should, quote, consider the opinions of other competent persons, including title agents and real estate attorneys. The title company is a title agent. It gets sent to underwriters who do these sorts of things. That was one, again, it's just the mistake that has just been really kind of self-reinforced in this matter. That's just not correct. And then I would just need to point out just all of the aspects of respondent's brief and basically his argument that just go well beyond the issues that are on appeal, talking about these medical assistants and some of these other things that weren't even identified from their expert. And again, it just really highlights the frustrating aspect of changing of the goalposts throughout all of this and stating that nothing was done between the order to show cause and the hearing, which is incorrect. If you read and look through the background facts section, there was many things that were done. And then just to go in and start saying that nothing was done within the 45 days, again, absolutely incorrect. And I hesitate to get into it because it's so beyond the record on appeal here. If the court or if respondents want to bring another order to show cause or contempt, then this would be before the court. But the record is what was the record before the court at the time of the hearing. And so it was frustrating to see that that was just the main aspect of respondents' argument, didn't really respond to our arguments, but decided to try to go off the record in a fairly substantial way, which required appellants to file their own motions to strike and motions to supplement with quite a few documents, which this court should not be considering, but out of the abundance of caution and necessity, we had to do that anyways. And so I would certainly just caution the court from and whatever they can kind of peel out of respondents' brief and their arguments, I would ask the court to strike any consideration of anything that wasn't considered by the court or could not have been considered by the court at that time, which are certainly not the aspect of that order to comply within 45 days, which they did by starting an action. And again, I don't want to get into all the areas and the things that respond or appellants have done to comply, because that's beyond the scope of this. But if the court would like me to go into it, I'm certainly willing to. And so if there are any questions about those items, I'd be happy to get into that. If not, I'd be happy to answer any other questions this court may have.
Okay, seeing none, you have 57 seconds left if you want to forfeit that, or otherwise you're welcome.
That.
All right, thank you both very much for your arguments. We appreciate it and your briefing. The case is submitted and we'll have a decision out within the statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.